Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Hi, good afternoon. We're going to cover, continue chapter 11 of Daniel that we did from last week, and then go into chapter 12. So I'm glad that you've been able to join us today. We're going to, like I said, we'll start here in probably, oh, actually, I know not probably. We're actually going to start in verse 29 of chapter 11 and run through the rest of chapter 29 and then go into chapter 12. We'll continue to talking about Antiochus and Antiochus the Fourth. Epiphanes is his full name. We're going to look at his second expedition into Egypt, which did not go as well as the first, as we'll see as we start reading here, and then introduce some new characters, some known as the Romans, as well as we go through this. But then, for the most part, I'll be talking about the rest of Antiochus's reign as we go through these final verses of chapter 11. And then going into chapter 12, we'll be reintroduced to Michael, and we'll see how that all goes throughout all of this. Hoping the audio works better today, as in this is the second time I've recorded this. So anyways, as we go through here, let's begin with verse 29 of chapter 11. And I'm going to read through 35, and then we'll discuss this a little bit more. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this is the last time it will, not turn out the way it did before. Something to remember, we had the kings of the south and the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north is Antiochus, and the Seleucids, the king of the south, or the people of the south, are the Ptolemies, and those are also the Egyptians, is what he's referring to here, because Ptolemies had control over Egypt during this time. Mainly Alexandria, Egypt, is kind of split up at this point. For ships of Kittim will come against him, therefore he will be disheartened, and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action, so he'll come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. From him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. By smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who give insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Then when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of these who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So what we're looking at here is, well, of course, the entry back into Egypt, and then him meeting what we refer to as the Romans, or Kittim, ships of Kittim, actually meaning the ships of the Mediterranean Sea, or people of the Mediterranean Sea, or the Mediterranean coast. Kittim is actually the ancient word for Cyprus, also known as the western coastlands, but also some islands in that area as well. I would mainly look at it as a focus just on people who are coming from or within, as in within being the islands of the Mediterranean Sea. So like we know here, as Antiochus is beginning the second rampage, I like to use rampage because this guy was a tyrant. He was crazy. As he goes into Egypt, causing all kinds of problems, he is met by these people. Like I said, he's most likely going into Alexandria, and the Romans, at the request of the Ptolemies, have been called in to help. The Ptolemies and the rulers there in Egypt, specifically in Alexandria, to come in and keep Antiochus away. So the interesting thing, of course, being knowing in the future that the Romans would eventually defeat the Greeks. And so at this time, we're introduced to the Romans before they really truly come into power. I guess it, lack of anything else, they would probably be best referred to as emerging power during this time. So that's what we see going on in verse 30. Anyways, as they were on their way to Alexandria, and as they were on their way to go after the Ptolemies there in Alexandria, they were met by a Roman commander by the name of Gaius Popolus Linnaeus. That's fun to say, especially if you say it fast, who was sent by the Roman Senate to confront Antiochus on his way to Alexandria. And during this conversation, the idea that came across is that either if you attack Alexandria, Rome will form with the Ptolemies and they will come after Antiochus, and they will ultimately be declaring war not only on the Ptolemies but also on Rome as well. And so we see that happening here. So what happened was, at least this is how the story goes, and it's much like how the line was crossed by Colonel Travis there at the Alamo. Anyone who wants to stay and fight in the Alamo can cross this line. Similar sort of thing happens here. The commander actually, instead of a line, drew a circle around Antiochus and said, "You cannot leave. You cannot leave until you give an answer of either you will fight the Romans and declare war against the Romans, or you'll leave in disgrace and go away back to Antioch." Well, anyways, if you're following along and are really a fan of this sort of history, you'll know that Antiochus had already faced defeat by the Romans, or at least the Seleucids did along the way. And so he remembered that. He also at one point was held captive by the Romans. And so he had lost the battle of, I believe it's Battle of Magnesia, and he had also, like I said, been held hostage. So he had some bad memories of the Romans. He knew the Romans were becoming more powerful, and he didn't want to mess with them. So in disgrace and humiliation, he withdraws from Egypt and heads back to Antioch. On his way back to where he had come from, the land of the north, he decides to pay a visit, or at least start sending some of his henchmen into Jerusalem. Because as we know with tyrants, they do not like to be humiliated. And when they are humiliated, what they like to do is they turn to anger and start going after maybe a weaker people. So the time period we're looking at here is probably about 167 BC. So this is most of the story we'll be going through today is ranging anywhere by between 168 BC to about 164 to 163 BC when Antiochus finally dies. So instead of him going into, okay, so let me, a few other stories before we get too far into this. Antiochus, part of this disgrace and walking away is that there is a tribute that Antiochus would have to pay to Rome. And he didn't really have the funds, or at least the funds were not readily available. So one thing he did is that he went, like I said, on his way back to Antioch. He went through Jerusalem on the way, or at least sent his people, some of his, I guess, like I said, henchmen through Israel or Jerusalem to collect tribute. One of the people that he sent was a mercenary by the name of Apollonius, and he was sent in, and at first he went into Jerusalem acting like he had come in peace, maybe just to collect some taxes, but at the end of the day he ended up slaughtering thousands of Jews on a Sabbath day, massacring them there in the temple, and pretty much plundering the city of Jerusalem, collecting the tribute for Antiochus to be able to pay off the Romans. The interesting other side of this is that there were already people in Jerusalem who were who had allied with Antiochus at this point. Some of these people were Hellenistic Jews. Some of them were like the high priest Menelaus, who we talked about briefly last week. And so instead of these high priests teaching and guiding the people of Israel, they had formed alliances with Antiochus in order not to be killed by Antiochus. But at the same time, the smooth words that you see there in verses 32, these smooth words is showing that Antiochus was a man of, he was a charmer. He was able to, for the most part, get his way by the way he spoke to other people, by the way he was able to charm them into doing things. And if he didn't, of course, what he would do is kill them. And so but at the same time, he was very much someone who could charm other people and convince them to help. And he had done that with Menelaus as well as other Jewish leaders along the way. Excuse me. Just I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but if we look at verse 31, you'll see a sanctuary fortress is a reference to here, how he desecrates this sanctuary fortress. This is showing how he will eventually desecrate the Jewish temple. It's referred to as a fortress possibly because it was known as a place of spiritual strength, so like a spiritual fortress of strength. But it's also at one point used as a military citadel too. So again, like I said, this time period we are in is about 167. That's about the time Apollonius shows up there in Jerusalem. And this is when the full outright suppression of the Jewish religion really starts to take off. This is where all the traditions, including scripture, sacrifices, their feast days, for the most part were forbidden, and if they were not removed or destroyed or ended up being kept by the people of Jerusalem, they'd eventually lead to death. While at the same time, while all their Jewish traditions and religious beliefs were trying to be removed, at the same time, the imperial cult religion was being introduced to the people of Jerusalem as well. During this time, it's probably around what we refer to as December. They would refer to on their calendar as about 15 Chislev. It hit its peak, and what we mean by it hit its peak of oppression is that this is the time that Antiochus put a statue of Zeus in the temple to fully desecrate the temple, referred to as the abomination that causes desolation. On 25 Chislev, offerings were continued to be made. They were being made to Zeus, but to put insult to injury, they were offering pigs, which, of course, as we know, Jewish people find to be, we'll just say, unsavory. And so they were, as you can see, insult to injury heaped upon the Jewish people. The temple was now completely desecrated, and there is no more Yahweh worshipers allowed or even around the temple at this point because there's no way they could worship. Why is this significant? Well, that's one way how the people of Israel were able to identify themselves as people of God, was the temple was the place where they could go and meet God, the place where God and they could interact through the priest. And so not to be able to have that place was quite a knock to the Jewish people. What we do know as we go into 32 into 33, because we start talking about people of insight, we start talking about righteous people. Not everyone in Israel, I'm interchanging Israel and Jerusalem. We know that around 700 BC, Israel was destroyed by the Syrians. And so we're really just talking about the North Kingdom, the Judah at this point. So, but they are still the people of Israel. But anyways, think about this. So in we'll call them the Jewish people. They're in Jerusalem. There were still some righteous people in that area. There are still true believers during this dark period. One of them being the people were known as the Maccabees, and they were from an area of Modan, which is about 17 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And they refused to forsake God. They refused to forsake their traditions or religious beliefs. And if you were following along the last couple of weeks, you saw that we had talked pretty significantly about what eventually became the Maccabean Revolt. I'm not going to go too far deep into that today because we've already talked about it. But for the most part, this family decided not to fall prey to Antiochus, and so they led a revolt. It ended up being a successful revolt. It took a couple of years after several of the brothers were killed, and eventually Judas, who ended up being referred to as Maccabee, was the victor over Antiochus, and Antiochus eventually goes away. Or at least is removed from power, as much power as he had. And at that point, they were able to rededicate the temple over an eight-day period, which is now what we refer to as Hanukkah. So that all happened during that time. And again, I encourage you to go reference 1st and 2nd Maccabees, what we refer to as the Apocrypha, or to go back and listen to some of these previous weeks that we really dug really deep into the Maccabean Revolt. As we continue to see in verses 33, 34, and 35, those who are wise, who have insight, here are the teachers. They, along with other faithful, suffered significantly. Many were martyred. what we're seeing here is Daniel, or the author at this point, is trying to make a reference to all of Israel, all the true believers of Israel, and how they're continuing to follow God through this significantly oppressive time. We know that tens of thousands of the Jewish people were slaughtered during this time, especially those who were faithful or known to be faithful. And a lot of these, the heroes, as you can refer to them, are referred to, if you go to Hebrews 11:34, that is a reference back to the martyrs and those who were faithful during this time. Going into verses 34 and 35 here, we see when they fall into a period of oppression, so those who are faithful will fall at this point, will not get a lot of help at this point. What this is, we believe, to be referring to or symbolizing is the Maccabean revolt initially was a small group of devout Jewish believers. It eventually grew over time. And it, as we go into 34, we see this reference to hypocrisy. And part of how this group grew is that as the revolt was getting bigger and the Maccabeans were having more power and more influence, those who were eventually, or at one point, against the Jewish people and on Antiochus's side, turned back to the people of Jerusalem and fought alongside the Maccabeans, but at the same time were called out as hypocrites. But that's what that reference is that we see here. So once they realized that they would be killed for siding with the Syrians, Seleucids, Antiochus, all the same thing, or relatively the same thing, they realized they were going to lose, and so they came back to the Jewish side of things. Going into 35, those who stumble or fall or to be persecuted, the purpose here is through the fire is to cleanse. So there's a purity option as we go through here. Each time you see the refine, the purge, and to make them pure until the end of time. Probably the better way to look at that is the end of this time, or the end of the period in which they're existing, the epoch in which they exist. And at this time, that was the epoch, or the period of time in which Antiochus IV was oppressing the people of the Jewish people. We know after this time, after Antiochus falls out of power, the Maccabeans took over. There were several other kings along the way for the next 100 years till the Romans take over. The period ended for Antiochus. The oppression ended. It still was not great for the Jewish people. If you look at the next 100 years, the kings were not great. It was a better time for the people of Israel, or the Jewish people, but it was not the best of times by any stretch. But anyways, the appointed time is the time that God decreed for Antiochus to no longer be in power. So like I said earlier, and we're going to dig a little bit deeper into this here in a minute, or actually once we get into chapter 12, Antiochus most likely died around 163 BC. There's some, not debate, but discussion, if it was 164, 163, and if you're really into that, you can dig a little bit deeper. But let's continue on in here, because it's going to get a little bit more, I would not say controversial, but a lot of what we're about to discuss as we go through the rest of chapter 11 is debated about who this king is that we'll be referring to. Excuse me. Who is this king? Who is the king that we'll see coming in verse 36? Some people, especially since probably about the time of Jerome, which was the 4th century AD, about that time, would say that possibly the king here is the Antichrist. Others would say, and even during Jerome's time and later on, would say possibly this is not the Antichrist, but this is a continuation of the conversation about Antiochus, and this is the Maccabean tradition continuing to tell a story about the oppression of Antiochus. Also along the way, the oppression of the other people who had attacked Israel over time, and how that had changed and shaped Israel over time. So I'm actually going to go in that direction. I'm going to go with the more historical account of the belief here, because I think it's overdone, this being the Antichrist, and I think the use of the way the end time has been misused in many ways, and I really, based on all the research I've been doing here, has seen this, the end times and the end of time, and this reference to the king is more of the end of time, in which the context in which the Jewish people were living when Daniel was written, as well as when Daniel was being read by the people in the second century BC. Now, there are, I want to provide, even though I'm going to go with the Antiochus IV, I want to provide a little bit of context about why some people would not believe it would be Antiochus the IV. One of them is that, remember, he did not exalt, and what we'll see as we read through 36 and 30, verses 36 and 39, Antiochus did not exalt himself above other gods. Remember, he did put Zeus, and he did worship Zeus in the temple. So you do have that as one example of where he did not think that he was the most powerful of gods, though he thought he was some sort of divine being. Another one is that he did not come to an end in what was known as, what you'll see is called the Beautiful Land, Palestine, Judah, all the same region. He actually died in Persia, which is where, of course, more of the northern tribe of where he, not the northern tribe, but the northern kingdom from which he came. So like I said, who is this king? Is it the Antichrist, or is it Antiochus? And we'll see a little bit more in chapter 12, verse 2, related to the king will live in the latter. There's some references to the king will live in the latter days. I'm looking at that, the latter days of the rule of Antiochus, that we have references to the resurrections of the saint will take place immediately after God delivers his people from the evil individual's power. I think there's some good argument that he's referring to the righteous Jewish people, not referring to people in general who are righteous, because a lot of times we like to take Daniel and Revelation and put it in our own world when that was never the intent of the author. And it also seems, and so you could argue also that this seems to be an introduction of a king of the first time, which again would put the argument more towards the Antichrist. So the Antichrist and the use of the word king here, not that the words are interchangeable, but you could, you know, pull Antichrist from king as a ruler over the earth during a period of time. So there's a little bit more argument there. The other side of it is that this is all about Antiochus, and there is pointing towards an Antichrist of what the Antichrist will do to the people, as in the oppression that Antiochus caused the Jewish people. So that could be another part of the argument as well, that it's maybe Antiochus on a historical side, in a historical perspective, but there is enough pointing towards a future Antiochus of what it could be like in the future. So like I said, you can pick your poison of who you think, if it's Antiochus the IV or if you think it's the Antichrist, in the following verses as we go through there. There's good commentaries on both sides of who it is. I've read them both. I've seen both sides, and I'm just going to stick with the Antiochus side of it at this point. So let's read 36 through 39. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for which is decreed will be done, which is decreed will be done by God, as in God decreed what will be done. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses. With the help of a foreign god, he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out the land for a price. So like I said here, I believe we're still talking about Antiochus the IV, and through verse 35 ended with God interceding as an appointed time, but then we're kind of coming back and re-looking at who Antiochus was and what he did. So the idea of doing as he pleases, as mentioned before, he is arrogant enough to believe that he is a god. Remember, he referred to himself as Antiochus the IV, the Epiphanes, which means God manifest. And of course, the Jewish people refer to him as Antiochus the IV, Epimenes, which means madman. So you got to take the context of the writer here is writing about a madman, someone who is, he's showing him as the madman, and contrasting that with the idea that an Antiochus thought that he was himself a divine being or God manifest. So like I said earlier, as he did as he pleases, and this was based on his charisma. He's obviously a very charismatic leader. He's very intelligent. He's also extremely evil. And he believes pretty much he can do whatever he wants to in the face of not only the Jewish God, but any gods. At one point, he actually even thought that he would go up into heaven, if you go back into previous chapters, and he would start pulling down or start defeating the heavenly beings here. So as you could imagine, with him referring to himself as God manifest, the Jewish people and the writer of Daniel at this point would not look too favorably upon Antiochus. Other things to look at here, he not only did not have respect for the Jewish God, he had little respect for his own gods or his own traditions. The author again continues to show contempt for Antiochus, and these references to the women is most likely a reference to the god Adonis. So he had no, just giving you an example of, you know, gods. Adonis was known to be a pretty powerful god in Antiochus's world, and so to be able to say that he had no regard for him or for that god not only shows contempt for the Jewish people, but also contempt for his own tradition. So as we continue on here and read through this and understand what's going on with the people as we go through 36 through 39, is that the faithful Jewish people had to stand against the oppression of Antiochus, and as well as the Hellenistic Jews and the others who were trying to come after him. They had to be courageous enough to teach others how to remain faithful. That's what the wise, the insightful teachers were to do, what the priests were supposed to be doing. But the situation was so intolerable that maybe, you know, even martyrdom might lead to the only way for the righteous to stand. So many of them became martyrs, and that was that reference I gave back to Hebrews earlier. As we finish up this chapter from 40 to 45, let's look at this a little bit deeper. So this is what was referred to, for those of you who really enjoy Latin, ex eventu. The author already knows some of the events that are about to be told. And so the story is already kind of known. It's being told to the people and being written to the people. It's almost like a prophecy of what will happen to the king of the north and his regime. But you could also say it already happened, and it's, you know, just kind of giving some additional information and additional direction to that. So let me read 40 through 45, and we'll just discuss that. At the end of time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he'll enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. Remember, the king of the south is the Ptolemies, and the king of the north is the Seleucids, which eventually led to Antiochus. We have to go all the way, to remember who these two are, we have to go all the way back to the time of Alexander the Great. His heirs were not able to take over all the land that Alexander the Great conquered. And so we have these four generals, two of them being the Seleucid general and one of them being the Ptolemy general. The other two, really, they matter, but you can go back to past conversations we've had about this to see who they are. But anyways, you have these two very powerful kingdoms, the north and the south, colliding against each other and fighting each other all over this region. You have to remember that Alexander the Great's span of power stretched all the way from Asia Minor, which is, you know, the eastern side of Turkey, to India. It was a huge, huge span of land that he had that was then broken up by the four winds, by the four generals, and then ruled specifically or mainly by the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. He will also enter, verse 41, he will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand: Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Those are names we haven't heard in a while, but of course are past enemies of the people of Israel. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things in Egypt. And Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to the end, and no one will help him. Extra points for two of these things. What is the beautiful land, and what is the holy mountain? If you guys think about it and have been following along, you'll catch on to those pretty quick. So as we go into these battles that are going on here, Antiochus seems to be using his past. His past actually seems to be directing his future. He goes after the king of the south, then he goes deeper into the northeastern territories, which it would be, of course, deeper into the Seleucid kingdoms, continue to take out additional people up there in the northeast. So he was all over the region, taking different people groups out, and of course getting tribute and continuing to gain wealth and power throughout the area. And as we continue here, we see a lot of references to Israel's past, of course, with the bringing up of Egyptian victory, how Israel had victory over the Egyptians and the Assyrians. Or advances against the Jewish people are recalled, where again with the Egyptians and the Assyrians defeated the people of Israel. If you went to Isaiah 8:8 as well as Jeremiah 46:8, you'd be able to see references to that. We also see a reference back to the Babylonian, how Babylon stretched out his hand over Judah, which what we see here in 42, which it could also be referenced if you went back to Ezekiel 30:25. Jeremiah here shows an excellent account of how the foes of Israel will be defeated, pointing ultimately to Antiochus will be defeated. So Jeremiah has a lot of really good references to what is going on here. Isaiah does as well, so does Ezekiel. You've got to think that some of those those prophets were around about this time or over this span of time, and so there's a lot of cross-references between this book as well as some of these other prophetic books. What we also see through verses 40 through 45 is that Antiochus' actions will continue to be outrageous until the end of his time, until his demise. We continue to see how the Jewish people will continue to suffer underneath him. Tens of thousands again were killed in the beautiful land, as we see there in verse 41. I imagine you guys have all guessed what the beautiful land is, but that of course is Palestine, or where Jerusalem exists, or the area in which Jerusalem exists. We've seen that before in Daniel, reference to the beautiful land, and so you get extra points for that. And then we notice here how the Edomites, the Moabites, and the Ammonites all show up. Just one example, we know the Edomites are relatives or long-term ancestors of Esau, who of course was Jacob's brother. And as we know, their history was not great. They seem to kind of make up in the end, but the Edomites were a people that would continually pester the people of Israel forever, it seems. And so you have these Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, all kind of is being part of past enemies of Israel as well, as we see through here. There's also a comparison here with how the Babylonians, Egyptians, and Assyrians spread like a flood, and they did. They increased their armies with foreign troops and were unstoppable for a time. I mean, if you go all the way back to the exile, and even you go back probably as far back as 700 BC with the Assyrians, and you just see how these powerful countries just show up on the scene. I mean, they just don't show up. There's a lot of backstory about how they show up and become powerful, but they're extremely powerful whenever they come in and start taking over. Of course, the exile with Daniel started with the Babylonians, and then we went to the Persians, and then eventually the Greeks, and now we're dealing with will eventually be the Romans. But you can see just how this has constantly been an attack on the people of Israel, and showing this comparison of a flood. The common denominator, though, is that we see here is that God only allows so much. They are all stopped eventually by God as they go forward. As we go into verse 44, And then wrap this up. Antiochus has left Egypt at this point, is now on the opposite end of the Seleucid Empire. His great, 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 probably if you'd say uncle, was Seleucus the First, and that's where we get Seleucid. He was the first general. He was actually the second general. It's kind of complicated how he got power, because there's Antiochus, who was the original general after Alexander the Great, and then Seleucus comes in, and then, you know, anyways, you have to go back and read all about that. It's very interesting. Anyways, they mentioned the Holy Mountain. We're looking at both 44 and 45. I imagine those of you who are following along guessed that the Holy Mountain is actually Mount Zion. He shows that he's pitched his tent there. It's his final battle is what that is symbolizing. It will take place in the land of Israel. For that is where his power will come to an end, though he does die in Persia. We also know, related to Antiochus, is that he had burned all his bridges. Though he was charming and pretty good at politics, it came to a point where no one wanted to be his ally anymore. So he was, for the most part, died the very way in which the Jewish people had described him as a madman. He was a madman. He had gone some takes of this, he'd gone insane by the end of his life and died a horrible, sad, disgusting death. And as we know, he most likely died around 163 BC, so we can determine that this book was probably written, or this part of the book at least, was written probably around 164 BC. So it just kind of gives us a little bit of take of that. There's not a lot of summary to chapter 11, I mean, as in the conclusion part, because if it wasn't for chapter 12, it would just continue to flow. So it almost feels like, and especially as chapter 12 starts, chapter 11 could have been 58 verses instead of 45, but I assume the Masoretes or somebody else along the way decided to put chapter 12 in here and to number it this way. But you'll notice here as we move from chapter 11 verse 45 to chapter 11 verse 1, it seems to be a pretty smooth flow, and the vision that we have here continues, or at least the information that Daniel is getting here continues. And the reason that we use that is we use some context clues provided to us related to now at that time. As in, it doesn't say now in a future time, now in the past, now later on, anything related to that. It says at that time, we are seeing that it is not a new time, but a continuation of what the people and is what the vision was going on in chapter 11 continues on into chapter 12. As we go into this, we're going to read 1 through 4 and get a little bit of context here. The bulk of the information that we get here is kind of in the beginning and the end of chapter 12. The verses in between are, of course, very good, but we see a lot of really good insight of the early parts of chapter 12 and the end of chapter 12. So let me read chapter 12, verse 1 through 4. Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of the heaven, and those who lead the many righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of times. Many will go back and forth, and knowledge will increase. Now, there's a lot of what we see early on here is symbolism that a lot of people will take to more long-term apocalyptic view. Now, Daniel, in all itself, is apocalyptic literature. But apocalyptic literature is not always future facing or far in the future facing. It's more of a prophet coming in and explaining what is going on right now and helping people kind of to work through it and decide and know at the same time, depending on what prophet you're listening to or what you're watching, that it's going to be okay and that God is in control. Some of the prophets weren't as positive, but here in Daniel we see that to be true. We'll talk about the books here because there's other times in Daniel that books are referenced and they mean different things. And this is one example where that is true. So let's first of all, as we start back in verse 1, Michael joins Daniel. So Michael, the great archangel, also known as Israel's patron and defender, the defender of the people of God, the defender of the people of God when God exercises judgment on his people. So Michael is considered to be, we'll get a little bit more into this, the most powerful angel or divine representative, because he is Israel's representative. And there's more to that too. And if you've been looking at the last couple weeks, you'll notice that we've already talked about these representatives of nations on a divine scale. So Michael returns to Daniel in this vision, and he has risen to defeat the northern kingdom. So he's risen to defeat the Antiochus. He's risen to defeat the Assyrians. And so you could argue that the Maccabean revolt and their defeat over the Seleucids, over Antiochus, was the work of Michael. A lot of times during that time, there was the belief that if there's a battle won on earth, there's a battle won in heaven. If you read the Odyssey and other related texts during that time, you'll notice also where the gods were involved with battles on the ground as well as vice versa. And so there's that sort of similar sort of literature that's going on here. Like I said, as we've discussed in other chapters, as we go through this, or as other parts of this, of Daniel, each nation has a representative in heaven, and these representatives fight both legal and military battles for the people they represent. And like I said, Michael is the one who represents Israel, so ultimately he is the one who stands guard and is the most powerful of all the representatives. And the reason, again, is because God has chosen Israel to be his people. Their destiny is guaranteed. You could almost say it's sealed, because we know what the end result for Israel will be. So ultimately, Michael is going to win out over all the other representatives, then, because God ultimately wins out on everything. So Michael defeats Antiochus's representative, thus allowing for victory on earth. The reference to those written in the book, as we look through these verses here, those written in the book are those considered to be righteous. The true list of Israel, or the true Jerusalem. So this is the righteous Jews, the righteous Jewish people. It is not talking about righteous Christians in 2020 or any time between then. It is referring to the Jewish people of this time. They could care less about what we were doing or what we're doing now. Their focus was the time in which they existed under the oppressive rule of Antiochus, how they were going to survive, how they were going to get out of it, and how God was going to rescue them as the chosen people. Now, I don't want to discount all that of what the future could look like, because as people who are, you know, 2,000 years later, what we can look at that and say, well, what this tells us is that it's a book of hope, that God is part of this. God is part of our lives. God is still fully involved with his creation. We can be people who are righteous, people of faith, people of hope. That's what we can take from this. Not that this is pointing to what's going to happen in 2021 when, you know, who knows happens. So this is not a end of time as in the end of the earth time. This is the end of the epic in which Antiochus ruled, and that Michael was victorious. If we look at it that way, ultimately God is victorious for his people. So in verse 2, again, I'm sorry we're jumping from 1 to 4, but we're going to be jumping forth in these verses. They will break free from death and show further, and as shown further in verse 2, like I say here, this is the book that's being referred to. It's not like the reliable book that you saw back in chapter 10, verse 21. That was different because that included the future acts of the wicked, as well as the future acts of the people of God. So I'm going to read that for you. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writings of truth. That's the book. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me except with me against these forces, except Michael, your prince. So it's being named here about who Michael is as their representative. And you have to think there's a representative for them. There's representatives for other people. There's other times in the Old Testament where you see references to other possible divine beings or representatives, angels even, and those are sometimes what we refer to as the representatives. Nor is this book like what you see if you go back to chapter 7, verse 10, where it is referenced to a river of fire was flowing and coming from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. The books there were recorded, for the most part, the books that they're referring to here, there, which were books that recorded the past basis for God's judgment of both the wicked and the righteous. So that's again different from what this book of the righteous Jewish people books that we're looking for. The hope that the Jewish people had, those who were righteous, they would be delivered from war, violence, suffering, and even ultimate death. And so we get that as we work through this. So again, this shows this provides a level of hope for the people as they hear this or read this for the first time. After seeing that the righteous will be vindicated, we find the first indisputable reference to in the Hebrew Bible. So mark my words, this is the first time in the entire Hebrew Bible, some of you refer to it as the Old Testament, to resurrection. The word itself. Now there are other times where there's ideas of resurrection come up, but this is the first time it is used in this way. So it is shown that those who are righteous will have an eschatological resurrection. So when it's all said and done, there will be a resurrection of the saints, is one way to look at that. We can note, as many do, that Daniel does not say anything about the last judgment and the coming of the Messiah. Now, there are some prophets who, you could argue, talk about the coming of a Jewish Messiah. We don't really see that here in Daniel. Really nothing is said about the character of a new age, but the prediction of a future resurrection, and that is something that's pretty nebulous for the Jewish people. They do not think about resurrection as we do, or what that even means. Again, they did not have a Messiah who is resurrected like we do, so it's a little bit different for them. So they have a theology of resurrection, but it's not really fully developed. I would even say that ours, to a point, is not really fully developed. There's probably so many things we just still don't know. So we cannot take this as a literal prediction. If you go back and you look at Jewish literature, the word or the actual term resurrection does not really show up until what they refer to as the rabbinic period, which happened sometime around the first century AD. Like I said, there were several words that were used in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible that refer to God granting life after someone's death, but not the actual word itself. And there's disagreement with scholars today. There were disagreement even back then about what the resurrection would look like or what that could possibly be. There are possibilities of resurrection throughout Second Temple writings, not only in Daniel, but in other Christian writings. There's also some extra-biblical viewpoints of what resurrection could look like. What we do know is that with this resurrection, that that's still, like I said, pretty nebulous to the Old Testament people, or people of the Old Testament, is that they did know that God was generous, and God allows for a continuation of life, not only for individuals, but for a nation itself. So you got to think, they were not just thinking on an individual basis, they were thinking for the nation of Israel as well. I think to fully understand this idea of resurrection, you'd want to spend some time diving into scriptures like Isaiah 26:19 and Isaiah 66:24, and then Ezekiel 37:12-14, because those do provide some good ideas or additional information about their thoughts on resurrection. So if you looked at Ezekiel 37, especially the scripture related to the Valley of Dry Bones and the resurrection, or the coming up, or the rebreathing of the people of Israel being depicted there from being dry bones into humans again. We're seeing not necessarily a resurrection, but a restoration of Israel. So you could look at that. God's care of individuals, as well as showing a resurrection for those who had been exiled during that time. Daniel doesn't provide as much detail as the other prophets do. It doesn't provide as much detail as Ezekiel does. Most likely telling us that during this time, The people had a somewhat understanding of what they thought resurrection or restoration meant. They also had access to other extra biblical texts that were related to their idea of resurrection. So there are significant texts outside the Hebrew Bible that attest to this. You have to remember during this time, and going well into the first century AD, the Sadducees and the Pharisees had debated about resurrection. You remember the Sadducees didn't even believe in resurrection. They didn't even think that was possible, while the Pharisees on the other side thought it was a strong and crucial belief to what they believed as Jewish leaders. So you have to think that it hasn't always just been an easy road for what this is or how it's described, and as we look forward through this. Now, you're going to get some additional information if you went into the Second Maccabees. So the First and Second Maccabees, which some of you refer to as in the Apocrypha, has a significant amount of information about not only resurrection, but how this was all playing out. So it gives you a really good historical viewpoint. So if you were to, I'm just going to give you a point. So if you were to look at 2 Maccabees chapter 7, verse 9, you would see a conversation that's being had by the mother of the sons that were fighting against Antiochus, and she's actually martyred. But you just read listen to what she had to say. And when he was at the last gasp, he said thus, "Thou indeed, O most wicked man," that's a reference to Antiochus, "destroyest out of this present life, but the king of the world will raise us up, who die for his laws in the resurrection of eternal life." So there's some sort of concept of a resurrection that she was aware of as she was speaking to Antiochus. The idea being that she had is that the faithful Jews will remain loyal to their covenant with God. Thus, through their faithfulness, they'll be raised up in an everlasting way. Now, we don't get a whole idea of what that looks like. You know, it was kind of hammered out a little bit more in the New Testament. There's still a lot of, still pretty oblique if you look at it. But there's a lot that we kind of get a little bit of an understanding of what's going on here. Ultimately, again, what the author is trying to show, not only in the Maccabees, but also in Daniel here, is to show hope and faithful God to people who've confronted unjust suffering and dealing with the death of the thousands of their own people and how they're dealing with it. The demise of their own traditions, the demise of their community is all happening, and how this allows for hope. This context sets up this message from the angle that God will provide the ultimate justice. With that justice, there is a resurrection, and for those who are righteous, as well as justice for those who are unjust. So justice is served for both the righteous and the unrighteous, as we see this going through here. As we continue on, like I said, the first few verses here in chapter 12 are pretty top-heavy, and then it kind of flattens out, and then at the end we'll have a little bit more. But as we go into verse 3, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground awake to everlasting life. We'll continue on through that. But when we talk about those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of stars. Those who are insight or wisdom are the teachers. Those are also the priests, those who have been given wisdom and who have remained righteous along this time, in this time of teaching the people about how to be Jewish. You have to remember, again, they're now back in there in Jerusalem. They're now back where they originally came from, for the most part. A lot of them are there. Not all of them returned, but for the most part, they're all there. And so they're still trying to learn what it is to be Jewish. They're still trying to remember what their traditions were and to keep those traditions. And it's something that they're constantly trying to do and remember and keep and grow. And it's something that we sometimes, I think, take for granted, that they knew how to be Jewish. They knew how to live this way. They knew how to do this, this, and this. But the thing is this constant education they had to have in remembrance of who they were, because it wasn't just Antiochus and the Syrians around, the Seleucids. There were other outside influences as well that were constantly coming after him, especially there's a Greek influence. That's why you had Hellenistic Jews. They were causing problems as well. And so you had to continue to work and help people remember why they are God's chosen people. The idea of shine brightly is a celestial reference. You see a lot of that in this sort of tax related to having kings or some sort of other significant beings being up within the stars. It's kind of that linkage that we've talked about before, about the linkage between heaven and earth. Again, this was discussed probably more in chapter 10, and so you got to think that's there. Again, like you said, if you go back to chapter 10, Antiochus thought that he would storm heaven's gates, so there's that connection between heaven and earth as well. He sought the honor to be up there within in heaven. Instead, it's the righteous saints who will be the ones who are honored and will be part of the council of Yahweh. You have to think about this is about life on earth as the saints, pointing to a heavenly character as the two, heaven and earth, are intertwined. As we go into verse 4, Daniel is told to hold on to the seal or keep away this vision until the time of Antiochus the Fourth. That would be for those who are existing and living during this oppression and during this time period. Once this time happens, the mystery will be revealed to the people. So they'll be able to hear what it is that God is trying to teach them and be able to have a grasp of the hope, a hope in the future where God rights the wrongs of the earth, of the tyrants, where God shows justice to those who are righteous, as well as justice to the unjust. As we continue on into verse 5 and going forward, we note again, "Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others were standing, one on the bank of the river, and the other on the bank of the river. And one said to the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the river." When we see someone dressed in linen, we know that to be a celestial being. "A question that we've heard before: how long will it be until the end of these wonders? I heard the man dressed in linen, who is above the waters of the river, as he raised his right hand and his left toward heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, that it would be for a time, times, and a half time. And as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed." I'm going to continue to read through the rest of this just to kind of give it all one good coherent feel. So verse 8 of chapter 12. "As for me, I heard but could not understand. So I said, 'My Lord, what will be the outcomes of these events?' He said, 'Go your way, Daniel, for these words are concealed and sealed up until the end of time. Many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. From the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up," we've seen that earlier, we were talking about abomination of desolation, that's related to the temple, "there will be 1,290 days. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. But as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion of the end of age." So this is kind of pointing to, Daniel's end, or his death, and what will happen for him, as well as some fun numbers get thrown in here as well, referring to some days that people are quite curious about and what that looks like for him. So as we go into this, we have the two individuals standing next to the river. We've seen river scenes before. We saw a leopard standing next to the river earlier on in Daniel. We've seen others, humans standing along a river if you go back to chapter 8. Again, pointing, typically when you see that river standing, there's some sort of revelation that's about to happen or some sort of important event is what you'll notice a lot of times what happens. So Daniel is witnessing another angelic conversation, or at least another celestial conversation at this point between two beings. And I imagine we aren't given a whole lot of details about who they were. And we aren't even given a lot of details about who the man dressed in linen above the waters is. There's debate and conversation about it. About being angels, just being other people, just being people as part of the vision. Assuming based on the contextual clues here, the one in linen is an angel, or at least a messenger who's providing some additional information. It doesn't specifically say if it's Michael or not. It could be, but we'll just have to kind of, we can work along with that as we go forward. In verse 6, Daniel hears them ask, hears him ask a question related to how long will all this take. Most likely it's the very question that Daniel wants to know. I mean, it is his vision, so he probably had some sort of influence about what this is like. This is again similar to chapter 8, verse 13, where there's a question, and this is related to the lamb and the goat vision about how long all of this oppression will continue. In verse 7, we get some fun symbolism here, or at least interesting symbolism, depending on what you think is fun, from the angel who is dressed in linen. We have a lot of mystery. Some would refer to it as a response that of a mystery and awe type response. Some of you would refer to it as a shock and awe type response. At first, he seems to be swearing to God, as in he's swore by him, as you see there in verse 7, not swearing at, but swearing by. We can see this reference of him pointing up to the contrast of the temporary suffering of those on the earth and the infinite presence of God, in contrasting the two together. The lifting of the left and right hand seem to symbolize the reversal of the fragmentation of the power of the holy people. It also is a sign of a solemn vow that's being said, or a solemn word that's about to be said here as he continues to have this conversation, at least to provide information. No exact date is given. That's why this is a mystery. And I don't say mystery in a I'm not just saying mystery to say mystery because I don't know. It's mystery because it's a revelation, something that will be revealed over time. We've seen in earlier on in Daniel where Nebuchadnezzar referred to mysteries, if Daniel could help him with a mystery. And what that means is Daniel could help him with a revelation to reveal the meaning of what is about to be said, or what about to be seen, or what is about to happen. So again, it's not just, I'm just throwing, it's a throwaway word, is what mystery is meaning here. As we continue going on through this, like I said, there's not an exact date is given, but we do get the time and a half, the time and a half and a half and a half. Anyways, that probably symbolizes what some people would guess is probably about 3.5 years. We'll dig a little bit deeper into that in verses 12 and 13, when we actually, verses 11 and 12, when we look at that here in a minute, when it gives you some days to work with. It doesn't give us a time that the suffering will end, but it does give them the hope that the suffering will end. So take that as you will. None of us knows when our own suffering will end. Very specific example, none of us knows when this coronavirus thing will end. It will end. God promises that evil, pain, suffering will end. We just don't get a, he doesn't give us a date. It's just the way this all works out. As we continue on into verses 8, 9, and 10, Daniel asks another question regarding the possible outcome of the events. Again, there are some answers, but there's still a significant amount of uncertainty. And that's how we have to sometimes live too, and that's okay to live in uncertainty and mystery. Not uncertainty that God is not who he says he is, but uncertainty is we don't know what the next day is going to hold. But we can have a certainty that God is with us, and God is, it's part of everything and part of helping us and guiding us, but it is, there's still that uncertainty of what exactly is going on here, and that is just kind of part of the mystery of the world in which we exist. Daniel is told to go your way, as in it's almost like it's ending for Daniel, not in a bad way at all, but I mean, you come to an end of your time. You come to, just like Antiochus, the very evil guy, came to his end. We all come to our end at some point. The end of our journey, the end of a time period, the end of a season of life. Daniel is to go his way. And he's been revealed so many things. So many things have been revealed to him throughout this book. So much wisdom and insight. He's known as a Jewish sage that has provided so much for the Jewish people, as well as for us today. But, you know, that season will end, and he'll have to continue on. So, again, does not fully answer Daniel's question. Instead, redirects him to what he's supposed to do. We see in verse 10 this purification that will happen, where you have this division between the righteous and the unrighteous. The purification of that, still not a lot of information here. As we know from chapters 1 through 6, is chapters 1 through 6 was the idea of the pure of the people, the Jewish people remaining pure and remaining true to being God's covenant people. That's what we see a lot through chapters 1 through 6. And that's what's going on here, is that how do we as a Jewish people continue to live righteous, pure lives? There are those Jewish people who've gone off and they become, they're now unrighteous. And then there are the Jewish people who are righteous. They are the pure ones. And so you have this divide between the two. In verse 11, as we go into this, the long question gives a bit more context and kind of another symbolic expression. The numbers are given are different from what you see in chapter 8, verse 14, and they're also a little bit different from what you see here in verse 7. I would say in a lot of this, just based on the research I did on this and the several commentaries I looked at and what this looks like, is that we're still dealing with Antiochus here at this point. It's providing some context of everything from the perversions that he performed in the temple for related to sacrifice, as we mentioned in previous chapters, to the time where the temple will be purified after a Maccabean revolt. And before we get into that, there's this really, really cool fun part we're going to talk about, and that's the calendars of that time, which will help provide some additional explanation. Remember, we're probably dealing in a time period of about 168 BC to 164 BC. Depending on how you match that up, and depending on how you kind of like to squeeze those calendars together, it could be about 3.5 years, which would be somewhat consistent with what you see earlier on from verse 7 here in chapter 12. But before we get ahead of ourselves, there were multiple calendars that were used during this time. And the Babylonians had their calendar, and it was the lunar calendar, which was 354 days. The Essenes, they had a solar calendar, which was 364 days. And then the Hellenists had a lunar-solar calendar. You can't have one or the other, you have to have both. And that was one of about 360 days. Eventually, they were all corrected, corrected to the true length of a solar year, which is just over 365 days. By what they did is they intercalated the months to allow that to happen. So as you can imagine, there's probably a lot of debate about which calendar was being used and exactly what intercalating means and how that was used for them to be able to do this. And so Daniel was dealing, or the writer of this time was dealing with, he's trying to explain with multiple influences, multiple calendars, of exactly what is going on. And it's our understanding that they ended up using a version of the lunisolar calendar, and it seems to be the most straightforward with what was trying to be accomplished here. So the 1,290 days with intercalation can equal about 3.5 years, and the 1,335 can also be calculated as 3.5 solar years. And so again, that is close to what we see back in verse 7, but probably just a little bit longer. Now, why would the author do this? Well, some would say that the author came in later on, an emendator came in later on and made some adjustments based on what was happening during that time with Antiochus. And so that could be part of it as well, is that the time period wasn't matching up for when this book was written to what was actually happening in that historical time. And so they came in and made some adjustments. Perfectly possible, and no problems with them doing that, because that happened with most texts. They were edited and redacted over time. Other scholars see two additional periods to represent very unspecified stages of a new era of victory after the persecutions, again, the persecutions of Antiochus. What we can determine, like I said, this is most likely between 168 and 164, and we can imagine a lot happened during that time period. But just to provide a little bit more examples here about what could have happened during that time, so verse 11 being the beginning point of this could be the time of one of Antiochus's first edicts against the people of Jerusalem, then leading to, over this time period, the actual desecration of the temple. So you remember when he came in after being embarrassed by the Romans in Alexandria, he came in and provided these edicts. This is how you should live. This is how you should live as my people. You can no longer be Jewish people. If you do, I'm going to kill you. All the way through the desecration of the temple, and then the enforcement of the ban of regular sacrifice, as we see in chapter 11, 31 through 33. Leading then to, you know, ongoing issues, and then eventually coming back to the Maccabean revolt, and then the rededication of the temple. So when it's all said and done, either way, what the point of all of this is that it's, again, it's showing that there was a story and there was an oppression, and Antiochus came in and he caused all kinds of problems. He caused the oppression of the Jewish people, but at the end of the day, God is there and God is faithful, and God at the time in which he chooses, as we see through all these examples of these other empires that have tried to take out Jerusalem, God will come in and he will take care of the people of Israel. So final verse of chapter 12 of the book of Daniel. we have a few things here related to the seer that is being spoken here. The seer is behind Daniel, and it's almost like he's looking forward or looking back, I guess, if this is based on when this was written, to the death of Daniel. This being in linen encourages them to face life, to go your way and to rest. Death, which relates directly to the discernment of all this. The picture of death as rest and coming back to life and rising from sleep points back to verse 2. So there's that reference from 13, verse 13 in chapter 12 to verse 2 of chapter 12. Another way to look at this, the second usage of the word go, we had go in verse 9 and we have go your way again in verse 13, points again, like I said earlier, to Daniel's upcoming death, the end of his season of his own life. He approaches his own rest at this point. His death is placed in the context, again, of his own resurrection, because what we know from what we've read here, the righteous Jewish people, the righteous Jew will be resurrected by God. There will be an everlasting life for the righteous Jew. So what we see from the beginning of this chapter, there in verse 1, Michael will arise at the final deliverance. So Michael, who returns as a representative of the Jewish people, will come, and there will be a reward for Daniel's righteousness. We'll also see the righteous will experience their final recompense of resurrection, whether they see the triumph of God's kingdom or not. There will be a resurrection for them, even if they would survive the time of Antiochus's depression, whether they become martyrs or not. Either way, they would see a type of resurrection as they went through this. As we wrap this up, there's just a brief summary I wanted to provide on the book of Daniel. And we begin this vision of Daniel, of looking at Persian rule, and it ends eventually, Persian being, of course, Antiochus, ends with the hope of everlasting life. So as we went through chapter 11 and chapter 12, and of course other parts related to Antiochus as being the last part of the three of the four rulers over the people of Jerusalem, or the Jewish people, there is that hope of everlasting life. We see this through this and most of the rest of the book, that the seemingly overwhelming power and control of the oppressive empires cannot withstand or go outside God's purview, no matter how hard they tried or no matter how powerful they thought they were. They cannot go beyond God's power. Also, that victory by God is assured not only on earth, but also in heaven. There is that dynamic between heaven and earth. We cannot forget that. We see too much evidence of that in the Bible, of representatives such as Michael and the earthly and heavenly move between that. Many can resonate with the question that the people were asking, that the Jewish people were asking, about how long. Now you have this individual on the river who is asking the other, the being who is floating over the river, how long. Daniel, the same question that Daniel could ask. And that's the same question that you know that the Jewish people during the time of the Holocaust asked. You know, that's the same question that Cambodians have asked, the Rwandans have asked, Bosnian Serbs, the Sudanese, all these groups who are wandering to God and asking him how long. Now they can look at a book like Daniel and they can say that, okay, God is in control, even though these are times of oppression, these are times where our people are being killed around us, a time of genocide. God is with us. As righteous people, God is with us. And so we can have that promise, not only for the Jewish people during that time, but for us as well. We know or have faith in the idea that God keeps watch over his creation. We know that he hasn't stepped away. He's not a deist, did not just step away and let everything just come and go crazy. You know, the future is not detailed. Just like in Daniel, the future is not detailed. We're kind of playing along as we can. There's always that little sense of uncertainty about what the next day will bring, but there's always that certainty of that God is here with us. And Daniel gets that same thing. Even though the angel does not spell out the mystery or the revelation that is being asked of him, Daniel is reassured that those who are righteous will have everlasting life. And we're reassured of the same thing. There will be cosmic justice for those who have oppressed the people of the world. We know that from what we see here. It's been in other parts of the scripture. This justice, we don't understand how it's going to work. It's cloaked in mystery. It's a revelation that we do not know of. We can decipher that the vision does show that the reader that there will be an absolute end to the world's tyrants. When and how that's going to happen is ultimately up to God and his timing. God provides us with a directive of home, but we never get full disclosure of what that looks like, which is the mystery. God only reveals so much of the mystery. And that's something that I find to be fascinating about the book of Daniel. We get a lot of information about God, but we never get the full picture. You look at the whole Bible that way. There's always questions that we'll have. What do certain things mean? How is this going to all play out? Who's where? How's this going to all work? All the how, what, where, when, why, everything related to that is what we see here. And it's something that we can, as people of faith, know that, yeah, we have questions, but the same thing, as people of faith, God is with us, and God is righteous, and he is here with us every day. This book also gives us the freedom to search for some additional meaning of what is possible, of what God can provide as people who are righteous and people who are searching for them, people who want to search for truth in our own lives, and have lives of hope in the midst of things that we cannot even fathom. And I think that's one of the keyest parts here. What the people, the exiled people, all the way through, from the Babylonian, the Persian, the Assyrian, Greek, Roman rule, you can imagine it was just a very hard time for them. And it's something that would be hard for us to even fathom. And there's times that we deal with, and we know of people who go through stuff that they cannot understand at all possibly fathom. But we also know that we can live lives of hope even through the midst of all that. And that's the promise that the book of Daniel provides. So I would encourage you to read other parts of the book of Daniel. There's so much to this. We've gone through the entire book, actually. And I just want to thank you for your time and hope you guys have a good rest of your day. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.